The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning. This will be the last time I teach this class for quite some time. I'm scheduled to leave for Burma next Monday, and I'll be in Burma for 2 months, both doing my own practice and supporting a retreat that is held up in the Sagaing Hills in Burma. And then the month of February, I'll be back in the country but teaching the month-long retreat at Spirit Rock. So I will be essentially gone from the center for 3 months. But the class will continue, and I have asked a couple of people, several people, to come and support the class. So there'll be some weeks where there'll be, you know, one person comes and then the next week a different person will come. But I have tried to arrange as much continuity as possible. So there'll be familiar people coming back each week. So this morning, I thought I would start with a verse from the Dhammapada. This is one of the collection of, basically it's poetry, Buddhist poetry. And it's one of the most well-known Buddhist texts that exists. And this particular translation is Gill's translation. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this translation. The particular verse I'd like to read to you is a pretty simple one. Irrigators guide water, fletchers shape arrows, carpenters fashion wood, sages tame themselves. One of the things that I like about the Dhammapada is that every single verse in the Dhammapada has a kind of a story associated with it. And I don't have all the stories, but I do have the story for this particular verse. So I thought I'd share that with you. I found it inspiring myself. So the story that's associated with this particular verse is the story of a 7-year-old monk. This monk, the story includes a backstory where what it tells what happened in his previous life or lives that made it possible for him to be such a remarkable human being at the age of 7. But I won't go into that part. I'll just tell the story of the 7-year-old. So from a young age, he apparently was very interested in the Dharma. And his mother, having had a sense of the specialness or the uniqueness of this person in her womb, made the decision when he was born that she wouldn't stand in his way. Whatever he wanted to do, she would allow him to do. And so at the age of 7, he requested to be ordained. So she allowed him to do that. She allowed him to go to the monastery and be ordained. And he was ordained with the Buddha's right-hand monk, Shariputra, the monk that had the most capacity with teaching the Dharma aside from the Buddha himself. He was called the Marshal of the Dharma. So he ordained with Shariputra, and for 7 days after his ordination, his parents were there in the monastery with him, offering meals to the monks and just being with him. You know, you can imagine, you know, a 7-year-old going off, the parents would kind of want to be there for the first few days. And the 8th day, after they left, the parents had left, and this is his first day, basically, his first day as a monk alone in the monastery. And Shariputra wants to take him out on alms rounds, but he hasn't quite got the right demeanor of a monk. You know, he's 7 years old, and you know he doesn't quite know how to carry his bowl gracefully or to wear his robes properly, and so Shariputra wants to give him a little extra instruction, and so he holds him back a little bit. They don't go off on alms round with all the other monks. So they're, after they are ready to go, they go off on alms round together, the two of them. And they're wandering through the countryside, and the young boy sees a ditch by the side of the road. And he asks Shariputra, "What is that?" And Shariputra says, "Well, it's a ditch." And the young boy says, "What is it for?" And Shariputra says, "Well, it is for the irrigators, the people, the farmers need to have crops, and the water is led to the crops through these ditches. And the farmers have made these ditches in order to lead the water to the crops." And the boy says, "Well, does water have a mind? Does water know where it's going or what it's doing?" And Shariputra said, "No." And the boy had the thought, "Wow, people can make this thing that doesn't have a mind. People can make that thing do what they wish." And then they went along further, and they saw some bow and arrow makers making bows and arrows. And he had a similar question. You know, what are they doing? And does the thing that they're doing, you know, does the thing that they're working with have a mind? And each time, Shariputra said no. They saw the people making arrows. They saw carpenters making wood, fashioning wood. And after seeing these three things, the young boy thought, If man with his mind can make things and make things go the way they want them to go, then perhaps I should try to do this with my own mind. And perhaps because the mind has a mind, there can be actually some additional movement. I'll see if I can read the thought that he had. I'll read that to you. It's kind of beautifully worded too. "If they can lead even such a thing as this, as water, which lacks mind, to whatever place they wish, why cannot they also have that mind bring their own mind under their own control and cause it to become enlightened?" So he had this idea, and he decided he wanted to go practice. So he said to Shariputra, "Venerable sir, would you take your bowl?" Because as a novice, he was carrying Shariputra's bowl. "Would you take your bowl and go into town for alms round on your own? I'd like to go back to the monastery to meditate." And Shariputra, it says that he refrained from having the thought, "This young novice speaks to me this way." And instead he said, "Give me the bowl and I will do that." And in fact, Shariputra went on alms round for the young novice. So the 7-year-old monk went back to the monastery, and it said that he got fully enlightened that day before he had his noon meal. So partly to me, I mean, the story is inspiring partly in that, you know, it talks about such a young person having the capacity to wake up, but also because it talks about the connection with how we do things in our lives, the skills that we cultivate. We cultivate skills to do many things in our lives. And this young boy's insight was, if we can cultivate skills to do these things, why not try to cultivate the skill of meditation? And so that's what I'd like to talk about today, is this skill of meditation. The skill of, because it is a skill. It's something that we can learn to do, much as people can learn how to dig ditches and guide water, or people can learn how to play basketball, or learn how to play a piano. We can learn how to meditate. And the capacity of our mind, because we are working with something that is conscious, this both helps and hinders us. Because we have the capacity to, with mindfulness, with consciousness, know what's happening in our own minds. And we also have this capacity to be unconscious. The mind has this capacity to kind of turn itself off and to operate on habits. And that's where we get into a lot of trouble. And so the skill of meditation is about learning how to wake up, learning how to know what our where our mind is going, and help to steer it in a skillful direction. So this analogy of the water, I think, is a good one. You know, that we can learn how to steer our minds in a direction that supports us. Now, I think it's interesting that, I think Tan Jeff points this out, Thanissaro Bhikkhu, and he's the monk that has written many of those free books that are offered over on the shelf in the community hall. He points out that the word that we use for skillful and unskillful, the word that the Buddha used for skillful and unskillful, or wholesome and unwholesome, what are wholesome qualities of mind? What are skillful qualities of mind? These are qualities that take us towards happiness, away from greed, aversion, and delusion. Qualities of greed, aversion, and delusion are the unskillful, unwholesome qualities of mind. Those are the ones that lead us, tend to lead us towards suffering. And the term that he used for this, which is the Pali term kusala, apparently it is a similar term that you would use in terms of a skillful arrow maker. Is a kusala, you know, a skillful arrow maker would be a kusala arrow maker. A skillful irrigator would be a kusala irrigator. So the term the Buddha is using is really connected to this capacity of developing a skill. And there are several qualities that really support this skillfulness. There's a list, one of the many lists in the Buddhist tradition, called the five faculties. And these are five qualities, five capacities that we can cultivate that support our ability to guide our mind in a skillful direction. And these five qualities are confidence, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about these qualities and then a little bit about how they interconnect. So this is the order that they're typically described in, that we start with confidence in our ability to do something. And with confidence in that ability to do something, given that confidence, we then have energy towards that task. With that energy towards that task, we begin to be aware while we are doing that task. And while we begin to be more continuously aware while doing that task, a kind of continuity of mindfulness brings a kind of concentration or focus on the task. And out of all of those arises a knowledge of how to do the thing. Now, this applies to any skill. These qualities really apply to any skill. And so, in order to really understand what it is we're trying to do in meditation, I like to begin this discussion with wisdom, with the conversation around wisdom. What is it that we're actually trying to do? We need to have a little bit of knowledge about what we are doing in order to even have confidence in what we're doing. So I like to start with thinking a little bit about wisdom. What is it that we are trying to do here? And the teaching on wisdom, there's several aspects to the teaching on wisdom, but one of the parts I like to reflect on is that there are three different ways that we engage with wisdom. There's the first way that we engage with wisdom is just to hear and to read, to begin to take in information, to gather the information. What is it that we're trying to do here? And the basic wisdom that we connect with in this practice, in the practice of trying to open our hearts and minds to wake up to the moment, to become present for the moment. The basic wisdom that we need to get some information about, to learn about, is the wisdom in the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, that there's suffering in the world, that the cause of suffering is our desire, our wanting things to be other than they are in this moment, that the suffering happens in this moment because we are not aligned with the truth of what is actually happening in this moment. That's not to say we can't do something to change situations, but suffering in this moment is coming from our not being aligned with the truth of this moment, what is actually happening. And that there's a path that we can walk that will support our ability to understand suffering and learn how to let go of the cause of suffering. And through walking that path, we can see how that letting go supports a settling and a release and a relaxation and a letting go of that suffering, letting go supports the freedom from suffering. So the Four Noble Truths, that's a little, you know, 2-minute discourse on the Four Noble Truths, is one key piece of wisdom that we take in. And there's many teachings around the Four Noble Truths. Understand suffering is one key piece of wisdom around the Four Noble Truths. Most of the pieces of wisdom offered by the Buddhist teachings aren't simply things to take in to say, okay, Four Noble Truths, I'll memorize those. But they come with a practice, essentially. And that's the second aspect of wisdom. So the first part of wisdom is taking in the teaching, taking in, learning it. The second part of it is doing something with it, reflecting on it, looking at how to engage with it as a practice. This capacity for reflection and thinking is a part of wisdom. So we don't simply take in the wisdom. We actually need to massage it, to work with it, to reflect on it, and to engage with it with practices. Understand suffering is the teaching of the First Noble Truth and the action associated with the First Noble Truth. Suffering exists and it is meant to be understood. And that understanding is a practice, not a thinking about. It's a practice of touching into, with mindfulness, the experience of suffering. So that's the work that we engage with. The third aspect of wisdom I will leave until the end, until I've come all the way back around these five qualities. So having heard some of the teachings, Four Noble Truths, the truths of impermanence, suffering, not self, the truth of what is skillful and unskillful in our actions, what supports our movement towards freedom and away from suffering, and understanding how causes and conditions lead us, that we essentially react with causes and conditions, and that the causes and conditions, we can shape the causes to lead to conditions that we aspire towards. So all of these teachings kind of fit together, and that, you know, the wisdom teachings, I've done a whole month on wisdom teachings, so this is a real short summary of these teachings. But there are these basic four aspects of wisdom: the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, the teaching of impermanent suffering, not self, the teaching of what is skillful and unskillful, and what leads us towards freedom away from suffering, and the teaching on cause and effect. We don't actually have to understand all of these teachings. In my experience, this wisdom is really potent. You can take a little tiny piece of this wisdom and work with that, massage that, picking something that resonates for you. If that's understanding suffering, if it's exploring impermanence, whatever it is that resonates for you in these teachings, if you just pick that little piece and work with that, it's like every tiny little bit of wisdom is the doorway into the whole of the teachings, if you engage with it. So, confidence. In order to begin to engage, to connect with these teachings in something more than a thoughtful way, to actually begin to do it, we need to have some confidence that we can do it. Now, initially, this kind of confidence, the confidence over time strengthens. And initially, we kind of have to have a leap of faith in a sense that, well, I guess I can try this. You know, the first time you sit down to play a piano, you know, it's like, well, I see I can push a key. I can't do much about making chords yet, but maybe I can, you know, I can do little bits of this, so maybe I can figure this out. It's kind of similar with the meditation. You know, we start with just the willingness to engage. And that even that willingness is the beginning of confidence. A willingness to say, I'm going to try this. Sometimes when we hear these wisdom teachings of impermanence or suffering is meant to be understood, it doesn't make a lot of sense to us. You know, we think, why would I want to understand suffering? I want to get rid of suffering. I don't particularly want to understand it. I just want to cut it out. Just, you know, excise it from my experience. So it takes a little bit of a leap of faith to engage in the exploration of these teachings. A little bit of a leap of faith to say, well, okay, I'm going to see what happens if I try being with my suffering, try to stay connected with my experience of frustration or irritation or annoyance rather than acting on it, and see what happens. That willingness to engage, that willingness to take that step, for me, at least in my own experience, had something to do with kind of a meeting of suffering and a feeling that everything I've tried has not worked. So this teaching here, the first little bit of wisdom that I worked with was something I got out of a book that said something along the lines of, it's helpful with strong emotions if you observe them rather than acting on them. If you see if you can just hang out with them, not trying to repress them or stop them, but hang out with them. And I tried pretty much everything I could think of, and I just thought, well, I felt like I'd hit bottom. And that hitting bottom actually was a place where I became open to hearing other possibilities. And so there was a little bit of willingness. It wasn't a sense of, well, I believe this. I didn't have a sense of believing in that teaching. But I was willing to try it. And the engaging in it, so that willingness, initially that willingness to engage, that brings energy to engage. So essentially, you know, we kind of see how this sense of confidence or sense of willingness leads to the engagement itself. It leads to some energy around doing it. And the more confident we become, because initially it is a leap of faith. It is a sense of, well, I'll try this. Nothing else has worked. I'll see what happens. And the confidence builds as one starts to see the results. That as we start to actually see, oh, this does work. This is helpful. And I've been able to do this. You know, this is something that didn't require, you know, sitting down with a therapist. This was something I could do myself when suffering arose myself. I could do this. I could be with that suffering. So that sense of confidence builds and increases the energy. It increases the energy that we have towards this practice. So the energy itself is that sense of engagement, that sense it's an energetic feeling of that movement, of directing our attention and our energetic choices towards the task at hand, towards the cultivation of the mindfulness, towards the exploration of the little bit of wisdom that we're working with. So it's that's the energy, is that movement of our action and our choices towards that exploration. Now, energy itself can be cultivated through making effort. And often the terms effort and energy are used synonymously. And there's a distinction between them, and I like to clarify this, that we make effort, and the effort actually results in energy. That's a little bit counterintuitive at times. We think that we need energy in order to make effort. And we do, to some extent. We have the energy of being alive here. You know, we are alive beings, and there is energy inherent in that. That's all we need to make the effort, actually. And the effort, again, the effort directing towards the cultivation of these qualities of mindfulness, of directing our attention towards what will lead us away from suffering, letting go of those things that get us caught up in suffering, exploring the suffering of those things that get us caught up in suffering. So we can make effort in those ways. And the effort is often in the form of practices, of meditation practices, of techniques. And as we engage in those, if we are engaging in them in a very light, gentle way, this is really key about effort, that the amount of effort that that is most skillful to use is actually a pretty small, light touch. That if we engage, for instance, in sitting down in meditation, if we sit down in meditation and we think, okay, I'm going to be present for the whole half hour. And we like try to build up the energy right in the first minute of the sitting to stay present for the whole half hour. That's a draining kind of energy effort. That will drain our energy. the kind of effort that supports energy, that actually increases energy, is a kind of effort that just does enough for this moment to stay present for this moment. And then you do it again. And then you do it again. Then you do it again. Over and over and over again. So it's like a very light touch to the staying with. The effort that we can make. It's like, for instance, in the breathing, staying with the breathing. Joseph Goldstein likes to talk about the secret teaching of being with the breath is to just make enough effort to stay with a half a breath. That's all you need to do. Make enough effort to stay with the in-breath. And then, at the end of the in-breath, make enough effort to stay with the out-breath. In that way, the energy will build, and over time, in that building of energy, there's a momentum. You know how energy works. I mean, it's like if you think about, a wheel that's stationary. Initially, you've got to give it a little bit of a push, and maybe, you need to give it a little bit of a light tap to keep it going. So you're thinking about, one of those games, the wheel with the stick, getting the wheel to move. Now, just giving it light taps to get it going. And after a while, it's got some momentum. And you don't need to tap it quite as hard or as frequently to keep it going. And it's like that in our meditation. That after some time of engaging that way, of enough energy, making enough effort to stay with half a breath, making enough effort to stay with the next half a breath, after a while, we don't need to even do that much. That the momentum of the energy that's been produced will carry us further. And so we can hang out and just rest in the experience of two or three breaths before we actually, got to connect again. Got to make a little bit of effort. And this effort aspect is really the art of meditation. Because in our experience, there's going to be a changing level of effort that will be necessary at any particular time based on all kinds of causes and conditions, based on how much is happening outside in the world, based on how quiet and still our minds are. We may need to make more effort or less effort. We may need to engage a little bit more. So learning how to read the energy that's there and how much effort is needed to support the energy and cultivate it is really where the art of meditation is. And we always are falling off one side or the other. We'll make a little too much effort, and we'll get tied up in knots and feel like, this is too hard and I'm getting exhausted. Oh, I'm getting exhausted doing this. Maybe I need to back off a little bit. Or we back off so far that we find that we're just wandering off in thought all the time and we're not connecting. Maybe need to make a little more effort. So learning how to read that energy is a really important and helpful part of learning how to engage in our mindfulness practice. So that energy directed towards the practice is really energy directed, much of it is energy directed towards mindfulness. And this is the third aspect, the mindfulness itself. This knowing what's happening while it's happening. The mindfulness is really it's what reveals to us, essentially, it's what reveals to us how our minds work. When we engage in mindfulness, we are looking at our experience. It's not so much mindfulness about what's happening in the world outside. It's mindfulness about what's happening inside our experience. And as we engage in that exploration of what is happening internally, we get an education about what is suffering in our minds. We get an education about anger itself, you know, or frustration or irritation. Often we don't actually, you know, before we engage in this kind of exploration, we're not so attuned to the fact that we are suffering when these states are coming up. It's much more we think that something out there is wrong that needs to be fixed, and we're not so connected with the actual feeling of the suffering inherent in these states of greed, aversion, and delusion. And so the mindfulness is directed inside. It's directed towards what is happening internally. This will show us not only what is happening in the moment, but it begins to show us the connections. When I do this, this happens. When this happens in the mind, this happens. And that's part of the power. This is really beginning to see the causes and conditions. We start to see the connections. We see a thought happen in our mind. And we see the tendency or the inclination to follow that thought in order to get angry or frustrated. You know, a thought about somebody that we're having some struggle with arises in our mind. And we start to see that we kind of want to get angry with them or want to put them in their place or tell them what, you know, they need to do right. You know, we have that movement of wanting to go there. And in our usual way of exploring the world, that's the way towards happiness. If we can get them to do the thing we want them to do, then we'll be happy. Then this feeling of frustration will go away. And what we begin to see with mindfulness turning inside as opposed to mostly focusing on the outer world, trying to get the outer world to come into line with what we want, when we start focusing on the inner world, we start to see that the suffering is actually in the state itself. The suffering is the frustration. The suffering is the anger. I mean, the anger is the suffering. The frustration is the suffering. It's not so much the thing in the world that's the suffering. What we're trying to do is to get rid of this feeling. And the only way that we know, the way that we've learned, is to try to manipulate the environment to get rid of this feeling. And the Buddha's wisdom is pointing us inside to say, see if there's another way to let go of that than by seeing if you endlessly trying to fix the world. See if there's another way to respond to that. And that's how the mindfulness supports us. That is the movement of mindfulness in this practice, to look at our experience. And in meditation in particular, not so much in daily life practice, well, some in daily life practice, but definitely in the meditation, to see if you can let go of the movement of thinking and trying to do and fix and change, more towards just the being with. Can you be with whatever it is, the feeling of the experience, as opposed to leaping out into the world of thought, trying to fix and change and manipulate? If you can hang out in your meditation with your experience, you'll begin to notice how it changes. And this will begin to show you that actually a lot of what's keeping these states of suffering in place is our own machination in our own mind. That's a lot of what's keeping it in place. So the mindfulness points this out to us. It points out the suffering. It points out that things are suffering that we wouldn't necessarily think of as suffering. It points out how our own minds lead us into that suffering. And it begins to show us the way out, how our own minds can help us out and move us away from that tendency towards staying caught in that. One of my people in a group this morning called it a hamster wheel. Just this hamster wheel of just spinning in these same patterns. So that's the mindfulness aspect. As we settle into mindfulness and stabilize in being able to stay present in the moment. As we learn how to be with experience without the popping out into all the thoughts, and can just contact the experience more continuously. That continuity of contacting our experience leads us into concentration. It's the continuity of awareness that leads to concentration. There are two basic ways that we work with that continuity. The easiest way, and the way that we generally start people with, is to focus on one thing, that we learn a continuity on paying attention to the breathing, that we keep coming back to that breath over and over again. And we begin to see through that continuity of breathing that the mind settles down, that it supports that coming into more continuity of awareness begins to support the actual letting go of all of the ways that we're pulled out. So the being willing to let go of the thoughts supports the more and more stability of the awareness on the breathing, a more continuity of the awareness on the breathing. Now that kind of coming back to one object, one thing, one experience over and over again, that's the classic way to cultivate concentration. And there is also the possibility to cultivate concentration just through a stability of awareness, that we just stay present for whatever's coming into our experience. That might be a continuing flow of change, a sense of a kind of a river of experience, a stream of flowing, changing experience. But that the concentration will come because of the continuity of the knowing, the continuity of the awareness. And it's those two pieces together of the mindfulness, of being connecting with our experience and knowing what's happening while it's happening, and the continuity of the awareness. Those two pieces together, given that we are working with the little bit of wisdom we started with, when we use that, for instance, that little bit of wisdom of pay attention to emotion instead of acting on it, and we apply our effort in that direction and be mindful of just the experience of the emotion, and that gets more continuous, we're just able to be with that emotion, at some point, you might actually see the emotion disappear. End. And in that moment, seeing, oh, nothing outside had to change. It was just the mind needing to let go of that emotion, of that clinging to the belief or the idea that I had to be this way, that I had to have this feeling. So the continuity of mindfulness and the concentration that develops allows us to start to see very clearly. And we begin to have clear understanding, direct experiential understanding of the wisdom that we are exploring. So for myself in that exploration, the first time I engaged in this, it was very much as I described. I'd read this book that had talked about, well, try this. Try not acting on your emotions, but paying attention to them. The willingness to engage. Staying in contact with experience. At some point, I saw an inclination or a tendency towards that emotion. And having spent a lot of time in that space of that emotion, the mind really clearly knew the suffering of that state. Really clearly knew the suffering of that state. And seeing the mind seeing itself headed there, I didn't have to do anything. was kind of like the mind said, oh, boy, I go that way and I know where I'm landing. It's going to be really uncomfortable. And the mind kind of just went poof and stopped. It just stopped that pattern just in a split second. That is and I saw that. I saw the mind just do it, just let it go. That's the experiential understanding of that wisdom, that I could see that the benefit in that moment, I really clearly understood the benefit of that wisdom. I knew inside my whole being the benefit of that small bit of wisdom. That's an insight. That's the third kind of wisdom. The wisdom of really knowing yourself. It becomes your own. That wisdom becomes yours. Even if for a split second, you know deeply in your being how that wisdom works. With that kind of internal insight, that really taking in that wisdom and knowing it. Now, that kind of wisdom is not going to come from thinking about it. It is not going to come from thinking about, well, what would happen if I just didn't pay attention, if I just, you know, paid attention to my emotions instead of acted on them. Well, I guess, you know, I can see how there might be some things. If you're just thinking about it, you're not going to get that third kind of wisdom. It's an experiential wisdom that comes about through the three part container or framework of using energy, mindfulness, and concentration directed towards understanding. And we need to know what we're trying to understand to begin with. So we come full circle. And as we have that kind of experience where we really understand something in our being, that supports yet more confidence. Because we know, when I had that experience of seeing, wow, look at that, the mind just let that go. It's like, wow, boy, I sure need to do more of this. That was my immediately thought. My immediate thought is like, wow, this stuff is really powerful. This stuff can help me see. I mean, I knew that had I not been engaging in this, that I would have been off on another rampage of anger in that moment. And seeing that it didn't happen was very, very powerful and guided me back into more exploration of this same teaching. So this is the skill of meditation. It lies in being willing to work with these qualities, to understand them, to get to know them, to get familiar with how they feel, to engage in practices and techniques that support their cultivation, and to learn what it is that you are, what is it that you are trying to do? That just simple mindfulness in the abstract, I guess I'll be aware of what's happening while it's happening. Just that isn't quite enough. We need to know where we're headed and a little bit about why. One of my teachers, Sayadaw Utejaniya, says, awareness alone is not enough. We need some wisdom, these first two kinds of wisdom, to guide our awareness. If I didn't have that little bit of wisdom about just pay attention to your emotion, don't act on it. If I'd tried to bring mindfulness to my anger, I'm quite sure I probably just would have gotten caught back in the loop of it. So having some idea of what we're doing and why supports the direction towards freedom from suffering, letting go of suffering. So we have a little bit of time for some questions or comments, if there's anything that...
Is our purpose to let go of suffering by recognizing it and recognizing when it comes and the desire that are not being our frustration about getting what we want? So is our main purpose is to eliminate suffering in our lives?
Well, that's an interesting way to put it. I mean, it's essentially, I mean, the purpose essentially, there's a couple of different things in your question. You know, if we have this direction of letting go of suffering, what will happen is that we begin to know more and more it's like each of us has our own expression or manifestation of what it means to be free of suffering. And so for some people, that might mean going off into a cave and sitting in silence. For another person, it might mean, like for Gandhi, engaging in the freeing of a political oppression. So I think in some ways, yes, the purpose is to become free of suffering, because that reveals to us how we want, you know, sort of an underlying way in which we move or want to move, or, you know, a movement towards freedom from suffering usually also means that in some way we want to support others becoming free of suffering. And that will manifest differently for everybody. You know, for some people it is the going off into a cave. And that does support, I mean, in ways that we can't know, that supports more beings. And then there are the people who are much more active in the world. So the becoming free of greed, aversion, and delusion allows the manifestation of compassion, of kindness, of equanimity to flower in the world. So it's not simply, it's not as simple as just like, okay, this is what our purpose is, you know. But that, to me, it seems like that, having that as a kind of a framework begins to reveal a broader, kind of a broader sense of where do I feel I'm of service here? You know, how can I be of service? Is that...
I was just thinking on an actual example. It's interesting how sometimes the topics that you have, at least for me, seem very relevant in the last, you know, a lot of the time. And I'm thinking exactly of this week where I was going to go down a path, not of anger, but of definitely suffering related to clinging, based on my work or what have you. And I could imagine, and I was conscious of it, conscious of the fact that by making a connection and thinking that it was going to result in other things, because it was such a perfect connection, I don't know if that makes any sense without getting into detail, and yet, so far, there's been no follow-up. You know, it's how that sometimes happens. It's like, what happened? And so I touched in to what was probably happening for me, whether it be my insecurity, surprise, I mean, a lot of things. But by being with it, really, it went away.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to do a lot of analysis. Just being conscious of it, kind of marinating in it, and letting it go gives me just a lot of calmness about it. If it is supposed to happen, it will. But I think just the point that you made before about intellectualizing things, I'm very good at. But actually touching into and using real-world examples and being mindful is very powerful, and I've just experienced that a lot in the last few weeks in various situations.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's what you describe. Did everybody hear her? I'm sorry, I forgot to have people using the microphones. Could you hear? Could you hear Sue?
Rarely.
Okay. What you describe about that willingness to just kind of stew, it's really hugely beneficial. And we do begin to see that there is a releasing if we're willing to just be in it without engaging in the thoughts around it. You know, that not only the intellectualizing, but the, well, they should do this, and I should do that, and this is how the whole thing should resolve itself. If we can just let go and be willing to be with the feeling, it's amazing how often we gain some perspective. I mean, not only that it perhaps lets go, but also that it's just like, oh, well, okay, well, I can see, you know, that there are different ways that this might be able to go, and if we have to continually direct things in a particular way, that we may miss an opportunity. We may miss something different. So, I mean, we can loosen our kind of tightness around needing something to be a particular way.
And last week in particular, you talked about the karmic knot. Not that I know if that is what this is, because that sounds very complicated a notion for me, but you just mentioned things about loosening, the knot unfolded on its own, that loosening happened, you know, because I was going to go down a very well-worn track that I'm used to, and I'm trying to create new tracks.
Yes, you know? That's what we're trying to do, exactly what we're trying to do with this practice, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, the meditation, the mindfulness, the concentration, it begins to wear new grooves in the mind, and also it kind of allows, even if we're watching something that's a habitual pattern, somehow the observing of it as opposed to the being engaged in it allows that to not get any more wired, and in fact it allows it to kind of begin to loosen. Over time, it can actually, you know, completely let go. If we're not in the pattern, engaged in all of that messiness, if we're just observing it, something about that actually, and I think the brain science around it is that you're using a different part of the brain. You're actually engaging the main cortex, the cerebral cortex, as opposed to a lot of the emotions come out of the deeper structures, the limbic structures of the brain. And so by engaging those other structures of the brain, it allows a letting go to happen in those deeper structures. There's been some research, I think, on that. So yeah, thank you. There's about a minute left if anybody has anything else. Well, I'll use this minute to just thank you and say farewell, and that I hope that your next few months are mindful and productive, and be really compassionate with yourself. This is a hard time of year for a lot of people, so it can be a challenging time. No need to feel like things have to be a particular way. Just allowing, a lot of allowing and compassion. So I will see you. What do they say? We could say Dharma willing. I will see you in 3 months.